The Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, April 30th already, which is a personal shock to me. And we are going to continue our public hearing on House Bill 5014, which is the budget bill for the operations part of the Department of Education, and House Bill 5015, which is the grant and aid bill for the Department of Education. Open the public hearing on House Bill 5014 and 5015. And before we get into the meat of it, Mr. Bender, can you bring the committee members up to speed on our new revised tentative schedule?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've distributed to you a copy that looks like a calendar, which outlines the proposed schedule for the subcommittee for the next 3 weeks. As you recall, tomorrow you'll be taking public testimony on the Department of Education operations and grant and aid bills. And then this calendar here shows beginning the following week, you see we have the department up for two more days of public hearing. And then starting a week from today, on Wednesday, May 7th, there will be a series of work sessions scheduled to work and report back to the full committee the budgets of the 16 other fund agencies that are in this committee. As you recall, you had public hearings on those early in the session. These are the health-related licensing boards and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. All of these budgets have no general fund in them, and the plan is to work through those in 2.5 weeks over the time period you see here in the order in which they are listed. So please, as you have time to look at this, if you recall any questions that you may have had on any of these particular budgets, please get back to the LFO analyst, and we'll be happy to work with you on those.
So, time to roll up our sleeves here and actually push some product out the other end of the process. With that, thank you very much for the update. And I'm sure the committee members eagerly await actually making something happen. Good morning, Ms. LaBlanc.
Good morning.
What we have here today, I think, do you have any information that you want to give the committee first off, or should we just jump right in here?
Madam Chair, there are some handouts that have been distributed. Maybe we could briefly go through those. And the first one, I hope it's still the first one in your pile, is some more information on the cost of assessments. Apparently there's more information provided from an outside source on the comparison between doing it in-house or outside of the agency. And so that's been provided for you by Mr. Audi. Mm-hmm. And then there were some questions yesterday directed towards Mr. Costi when he did his presentation on technology, and he's provided answers to those questions for you in a memo to the subcommittee. And then there was a discussion yesterday about the definition of highly qualified teachers, and Vicki Chamberlain from TSBC has provided some information on that for you to read. And I believe that's it. There was one slight oversight in the schedule yesterday. Mr. Costi actually wasn't finished with his presentation. We skipped the office at School Finance, so we thought what we'd do today is
he will double back, right, and hopefully make that mistake rectified. So with that, then, we call Bob Siebert back up to finish the presentation on the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Siebert, Associate Superintendent for the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. I believe where we left off yesterday was on slide 12 in the Curriculum Instruction and Field Services slides. So I'll return there and sort of pick up the narrative. There were several questions from members yesterday, and I wanted to just address those very briefly as an introductory to the remainder of my presentation. Senator Gordley asked if private universities were involved in the Title IIA grant program administered by OUS, and I have today a list of the OUS grants, which does include private universities as grantees for this program, and if the chair wishes, I could make that information available. But they do participate in the program. They are eligible for grants. They do compete, and in fact, two of those universities, private colleges, were successful this round with that program. Senator Messerly asked a question concerning what schools are doing with their Title II aid dollars that are made through the formula to those school districts. I do have a list district by district that really sets out sort of the two types, two ways that school districts are using the funds this year in 2002-2003. One of the ways that districts are using it is for class size reduction. In other words, as budgets have shrunk in school districts over special sessions and through this year, the Title IIA dollars have been available to maintain a certain class size in schools, and about two-thirds of the dollars that we make available to school districts are used for that purpose, to maintain a level of service through the rest of the school year as they reduce their budgets. The remainder of the funds, about $10 million, are available to school districts for professional development. Schools are using, districts are using those monies for professional development, and there's a wide array of what they use the dollars for, from instructional programs and training for counselors, elementary teachers, math teachers in the high school. There's a whole wide variety of activity, as is allowed under the federal law. So until we have some data on highly qualified teachers, and we have an ability to look at schools in terms of qualifications of teachers, that districts are allowed to use the dollars as they see the needs in their districts and to target those dollars to those programs. I could make that the basic data available to you if you wish. I have copies of it here. I think another question I want to address, and it really starts with slide 12, and that is the accountability issue that you raised yesterday. What are we accountable? What is the Department of Education accountable for, and what are school districts accountable for? Under, I think we focused in on the Title IIA program, but I think the question is really a broader question about accountability and how do we ensure that we're accountable for what we can do and what we are required to do, and how do we hold school districts accountable for doing the work that is required by federal law or under statute for the state of Oregon. Under the Title IIA program, the accountability really is that all teachers in the state of Oregon in every school meets the standards for a highly qualified teacher. This federal government has set the standard of 100%. We need to ensure that 100% of the teachers are highly qualified over the next 4 years. We're currently prepared to collect the data from school districts. This is the first year of the implementation of the data collection process as required under federal law. And we will determine what is the level of the teachers, what numbers of teachers are highly qualified, and those who do not meet the highly qualified standards under federal law. At that point, we need to submit a plan to the federal government that talks to how we intend to work over the next 4 years in bringing that the level of highly qualified teachers to 100%.
Sure. Can I just, for personal clarification purposes, ask a question here? So when you say qualified as a highly qualified teacher, what you're saying is that the qualification means that a teacher has gone through a certain amount of training and has been certified to have had that training and completed it successfully?
Madam Chair, I think there's actually two things that we look at. One of those things is licensure by the state of Oregon, and Vicki Chamberlain is here again if you wanted to ask her questions about the licensure and our standards that we're using to determine highly qualified teachers under the state standards through the Teacher Standards Practice Commission.
We have a...
And you have that,
yes,
right.
Vicki,
and that's fresh off the press. I mean, that was completed day before yesterday at 5:30 in the afternoon. This will go into our report to the federal government, and our proposal for what highly qualified, the standards for highly qualified teachers in the state of Oregon are, the federal government will review those, give us feedback, either approve it or ask for revisions. So that's sort of the stage that we're at with that process. There's a second, so licensure is certainly one of those issues. What are the basic standards that we require for every teacher to meet in order to be employed in schools as a teacher? The second is capacity. It's a capacity question, which is really, I think, the work of the Department of Education and school districts. That's a supervision question. How well is the teacher doing in the classroom with children? How well are the children doing under with that teacher? Sort of goes to the questions you asked yesterday about student achievement and teachers, and how do we enter into the discussion under a supervisory model, performance of children in classrooms for the teachers that are teaching them.
Well, and the question that I have is around, I mean, the piece that I'm interested in is, you theoretically have these people that are trained in the theory and whatever practical experience that they're gauged on while they're in that training process, then they get their certificate or whatever it is that they need to have to make that benchmark, and then they're in the classroom. And what I'm curious about is what it is in the classroom that you are using to gauge them by. What kind of data are you gathering? How are you making a body of information apparent that you can use to judge how a teacher is actually performing?
Right. Madam Chair, I think here's the way I would respond to that, and I think there's some work for the Department of Education to do, and I think there's work for schools to do. When a teacher is licensed by a Teacher Standards Practice Commission, exits a higher education institution program, they enter into employment and become responsibility really of their supervisors in the schools, the building principal, other supervisors that manage and address supervisory needs of the teachers. It becomes really their responsibility to evaluate teacher performance in the classroom. Certainly student achievement should be one of those characteristics that the teacher is evaluated on. To the extent that they're able to have the data today to do that is problematic. Some do and some do not. I think the department's responsibility is to ensure that we can collect the data, that we can provide it to the teacher supervisors, and that we assist them in carrying out that evaluation responsibility with teachers.
Madam Chair.
If I might. But what I hear you say then is at the present time we don't collect the data and we don't have the ability to use the information that we have that tracks student progress through the system as a way to gauge whether teachers are being effective or not?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I think you had the same question. I think you heard from Doug Costi yesterday, our technology director, that currently we are collecting data on student performance through the state achievement tests. And we have that on a student level basis. To the extent that we can link that to the teachers of those children, we don't have that capacity and capability at this point. So can we make that connection at this point? No. Are we driving in that direction? Yes. We will be able to at some point. Now, there's a lot of technology questions, a lot of data questions that we have to resolve before we can actually do that.
Well, having admittedly a very shallow knowledge of how databases are constructed, it doesn't seem to me like it's a very complicated piece just to add another field in the database that lists the name of the teacher. And so I'm curious about why this is all kind of shrouded in conditional language.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm smiling is that I'm at the end of my capability of explaining the technology behind what needs to be done. I think Director Doug Costi could address the issues of all of the infrastructure that you need to be able to bring that data to bear and to be able to combine it and collect it and combine it so that we could make that kind of a report. We're really talking about a report that that supervisors would get. It isn't as easy as just putting another field on the form. There's a whole variety of technology infrastructure issues that need to be addressed as well in the development of those infrastructure issues. And that really truly is sort of the level of my understanding about how the underlying technology works for this, for getting that data and making it available in an understandable form. And really what we need to do is make sure that when principals get that data, that it's understandable to them and that they can use it in their evaluations, supervision responsibilities.
Senator Gordley, do you want to go with this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll go at a part of this. Again, focusing on improving teacher quality, and it would be good and helpful for Vicki Chamberlain to weigh in on this at some point, Madam Chair. If we're going to get to improving teacher quality, then a part of our focus has to be on our certification process. And as I understand it, currently, a teacher being granted a license to teach, does not have to demonstrate competency teaching reading, for example, or competency teaching math, for example, in order to gain certification. That's one of the pieces I'd like to hear addressed with regard to what is our plan to shift our certification requirements in a manner that allow us to address that piece, the lack of competency or the need to improve competency, so that we can get to increased teacher quality. And again, that directly relates to what we may be able to do for students in the classroom with regard to increasing achievement.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I'm just going to tackle that head on. What are we doing to achieve competency? And I want to be sure that we know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. If a teacher decides to get a reading specialist endorsement, they have done everything they can to demonstrate their ability to teach reading. We don't require a reading endorsement for elementary teachers, and likewise with math, if they acquire a math endorsement. So I think we're talking primarily, what are we doing for our pre-K-8 teachers to make sure that when they're in those classrooms that they can teach reading and math? Today, the only measure of that we have is the multiple subjects assessment test for teachers that we call the MSAT, is the acronym you'll see throughout our stuff, which includes tests on teachers' capability beyond the basic skill level for math and reading and writing and other multiple subjects for elementary teachers. What I could not ever tell you is that because I passed the MSAT, I would be competent to teach reading and math today, frankly. We haven't ever done that research. It'd be interesting research. So what are we doing now? Well, it's just happenstance that we have to get rid of that test. It's just not going to be continued and updated and by the Education Testing Service. So now with No Child Left Behind is an opportunity for us to look at how we do test our elementary teachers. And so part of the multiple, it looks like in the absence of one test that tests multiple subjects, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to test teachers on multiple subjects with multiple tests. So that is within the next 3 years something that we have to develop. Developing tests is extremely costly and long protracted process so that they're valid. So I'm also hoping that we can keep an eye on what Washington State is doing, because they're rolling out new tests for elementary teachers on these exact topics, and that we can collaborate with them and save some money. So that's what we're doing now. We're looking at how we're going to be testing our elementary teachers in those subjects.
I'm fine. Go ahead.
You look like you need to ask an additional
question.
Or make a comment.
This is, again, for Vicki Chamberlain. How do we address this area? Are we in need of legislation? Are we in need of administrative rule? What will get us to where we need to go to ensure that we have in place the pieces that will support No Child Left Behind, and that will support us getting to where we need to go to improve teacher quality? Is there something needed from the legislature or not, or do you have enough support in your role, your administrative role, to accomplish what needs to happen by administrative rule?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't believe we need legislation. I think we have the authority and latitude we need in the statutes that you've given us to operate. I do think we need to do some things. We will be adopting administrative rules for this. I think we're I'm slightly empty-handed for an answer for you is a step that wouldn't be required by the federal law, but probably would be really necessary and important is to go back and relook at the standards that we have to license our teachers and see whether or not they're clear enough about the competencies that we want teachers to have when they come out. And I think that's an issue we talked about during our hearings. And so that's the opportunity that we have to tackle head on the subject matter competency for our teachers, the cultural competency issues that we've talked about, and other issues like that. So I couldn't tell you, truthfully, that based on the standards that we have in our administrative rules, that if those were fulfilled, that a person would have a level of competency other than what they showed to us by passing a test. Mm-hmm. And so just as a, I think this fits. I think our struggle is, are our tests stringent enough, and are the standards we set for licensure going to be a significant step for making sure we have a competent teacher in the classroom? We think so. And then I think what Bob was trying to say that was helpful is that the only way we have today to measure that is how our students do on assessment tests, mm-hmm. and whatever the administrators do to evaluate the teachers. Mm-hmm. So the model I was thinking about is, many of you know, I'm a lawyer too, and I had to pass the bar, and I had to do a lot of work to pass the bar. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I was a great lawyer out in private practice. And I think that's a struggle that we have with teaching and licensing. We try to set a high bar, and we try to say this is all the things we think they need, and then we know they get in the classroom and they fail, some of them, not all of them, obviously, because we think our students are doing pretty well. So I don't know what to say to you other than I do think we have to keep our eye on it, and we do have to be accountable, and that No Child Left Behind adds an extra step of accountability, because now we have to report how our teachers are educated and what subjects that we have, and people are going to be keeping a closer eye on, gee, if I'm a highly qualified teacher in math, how is my daughter doing? Or if my daughter has a highly qualified teacher in math, how is she doing? And I think that helps.
Well, Madam Chair, let me just say this to Ms. Chamberlain. Actually, you've said a great deal, mm-hmm. and what you've said gives me confidence in the quality of your leadership at the Commission to move this effort forward, to move in the direction that we need to go. So I want to say that. I would also be interested in hearing later from Deputy Burke, if he has a perspective on mm-hmm. this particular issue as well. But again, I'm very appreciative of the way that you've responded, and you bring outstanding leadership to the Commission at a moment in time where what's required is exceptional quality mm-hmm. and exceptional Thank quality you. In leadership.
Thank you.
Mr. Siebert, you were going to make a comment?
Yeah, let me just add this to what Vicki has said, and that is that as a beginning teacher, lo, these decades ago, what I found is that I was well prepared as an undergraduate to do certain things, to know certain things, to impart to teachers. What I found is, and I think every teacher does, that the first several years of actually being in a classroom with kids every day for a school year is the real training ground, and it's OJT, it's on-the-job training. We need to, and I've always thought this, that the highly qualified teachers law really also needs to be addressed to the highly qualified administrator's job, the one who's responsible to evaluate and support that teacher in the classroom, help them grow, help them understand how to do the job and how to do a job effectively. I think that Title IIA provides us some federal resources to address those issues, and are the issues that we would be addressing over the next several years to help teachers become better teachers in the classroom, using performance data of students, but also using other data, other characteristics of teachers that are very good with kids.
Senator Messerly, did you have a question that you wanted to ask?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to comment that Ms. Chamberlain is getting close to the issue that I brought up earlier in this session about, do the individual teachers have the ability to motivate mm-hmm. and the students and focus on that. But the question I have that I think the chair is referring to, Mr. Siebert, I was shuffling papers up here when you were starting your presentation. I apologize for that. But I heard you mention that some of the funds were being used to relieve the pressure on oversized classroom class size. What funds was that you were referring to?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, it's Title IIA of the No Child Left Behind Act. It is it's called the Highly Qualified Teacher Component. That's the name of the grant program. These funds are made available through a formula that we administer. The formula really predicts and dictates how those dollars are distributed to school districts. There's no discretion on our part about how many dollars each school district gets. When the district receives those funds, they have several alternatives to choose from in how they use those dollars, including the class size reduction program that was a predecessor to the No Child or to the Title IIA program under the new act. They are allowed to do that. They can make that choice locally. The state has no authority to tell them they can't do that. And given the current financial situation, many districts have chosen to use their Title IIA dollars to can maintain a level of caseload or class size in the schools. They are allowed to do that in the future. However, once we do get the data on highly qualified teachers, the state can start working with those school districts on the issue of how do you bring all teachers up to the status of being a highly qualified teacher under the No Child Left Behind, and we plan on doing that. We're just now getting prepared to collect that data this spring.
And is that the follow-up, Madam Chair? Is that part of the $81.6 million that we see on the screen there now?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, yes, it is.
And it follow-up? Is there a criteria of what percentage they could... two questions. Does this go to all districts in the state? And is there a criteria of the percentage of those funds that can be used for class size reduction, or is it totally up to the district?
Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, every district does get an amount of money. It's based on the formula. And they have discretion, total discretion over those dollars right now to use those dollars within the parameters of the federal law, which includes they could apply it to class size reduction.
I think we should get back on track.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, the remainder of this presentation can go rather quickly. We've talked about the general purposes of our office and the general activities that we conduct. I just want to go through the next several slides rather rapidly. However, I do want to make another point, which is the accountability. I want to go back to the accountability issue. Implementation of academic standards is actually an accountability issue. The State Department of Education provides school districts with a set of standards for each academic area. Those standards are the basis upon which the state assessments are based, and that we provide then assistance to school districts to ensure that their curriculum is aligned with those standards. The input is that we ensure that those standards, that the curriculum is aligned. The output is the student achievement assessments. That then allows us to look at how students are doing and also allows us to look at the true alignment of the standards with the school district's curriculum. So to have it broken out as number one as curriculum standards, number three as school and district accountability, really those are two sides of the same coin. They're both really accountability measures, accountability activities that the department undertakes. Improving teacher quality, I think we discussed, and so I'll go to the next slide, which talks about three additional activities or emphases that the Office of Curriculum Instruction Field Services uses. A fourth activity is school and student recognition. The Office of Curriculum Instruction Field Services believes, and I personally believe, that we need to hold districts accountable for high levels of performance. I also believe that once a school achieves that high level of performance, we need to recognize that. We need to call that to the attention of other schools and other elements of our society that we, in fact, have schools that are performing very well. The school recognition program is one of those ways that we recognize that we have many, many schools that are doing exceptionally well in our state, do have high student achievement, and do very well on the Oregon Report Card. And I believe that we catch them while they're being good and allow people to see that and recognize it and applaud that success that they've had. School choice is
how do you spend this money?
If you'll turn to... Let's see. Turn to slide 17. There's actually two functions that we do within that student and teacher and school recognition programs. We recognize exceptional schools as one of those. The current activity was started by two superintendents ago, actually, under Superintendent Norma Paulus, when we started the report card process. And what she wanted to do is to be able to recognize a school for its high level of success. She wanted that to be a recognition by the local community as well as the state, so that that the patrons of the schools would feel pride in the schools and their achievements. What we've done really as a symbol of that recognition is provide them with a flag that they can fly on their flagpole in front of the school. It says, this school is a high-performing school. It got an exceptional score on an Oregon report card. It's a very low-cost recognition program. Our staff go out and present that flag to those schools, meet with the community, do a student body assembly, and recognize the school and the students for doing as well as they've done. It's very low overhead, and it's very successful in getting the community involved in participating in that school. So it's, I think, a very effective process.
$83,500 a biennium on flags?
No, Madam Chair. We also do a student recognition program. We do that currently through the statewide spelling contest. We involve literally thousands of children across the state through ESD competitions, school district competitions, and then finally, as you probably are well aware, we do the final competition with many kids at the state fair during the state fair. It does cost staff time. It does cost some extra dollars to assist the ESDs and the school districts for carrying out that competition. It's a way to recognize student performance, student success. Okay. That's a component of that $86,000.
Presidential awards are...
Presidential awards is a federal grant program that we support administratively. The federal grant program awards amounts of dollars to high-performing teachers in our state in math and science. The dollars that we use for administration purposes is basically staff time and some support for letter sending and communications. Leverages about $40,000 a year in federal dollars that go to those teachers for participating on a national basis with other states with very highly capable math and science teachers. That all put together comes up with the general fund dollars that you have there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now we'll go back. Let's see. Where was I? Back to slide 13. So I talked about student and school recognition. Schools of choice. Under state law, you will see that we have many choice programs that we administer and organize and administer. And we also do support to local schools. And I want to go to the and I should skip over slide 14 because we really talked about standards some bit. We talked about improving teacher quality in slide 15. And we've actually talked about slide 16 to some extent and slide 17. So if we go to slide 18, schools of choice, we do several types of alternative or choice programs in the state, those being alternative schools, both operated by public and private, in public and private settings for children that need alternative settings to be successful as students. We operate private schools through a registration process and technical assistance so that they can understand state requirements around standards and assessments and all those things if they want to participate, and we do provide that assistance to them. We operate a rather large federal grant program under charter schools that provides close to $10 million in grants to potential charter school programs to help assist them in planning, assist them with communication with their local school board, to determine if the charter school will be successful as a charter school within that district. We provide them with additional planning assistance through local grants to these charter programs and a lot of technical assistance, because generally many of the staff that work in charter schools aren't as sophisticated in much of the state law around both charter schools and about public schools and how the public schools operate. So we provide a lot of work with them to help them think through how they could become a charter school in their local school district.
Is the $10 million federal funds in this category all in the charter schools part of the program?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. We also operate under state law the homeschooling program and work with parents that are homeschoolers. This, generally speaking, is a an effort on the office's part to provide information to those homeschooling parents about regulations under the law and also about resources that they can obtain. We provide them with a lot of information that they would have about how they can work as a homeschooling parent, how can they work in cooperation with their local schools, how can they work in cooperation with the state and under the state regulations. There's not a lot of money into supporting this. However, there is. We find that parents of homeschooling children have lots and lots and lots of questions. They want to know a lot of things about standards and requirements around curriculum and content. They want to know a lot of things about how they operate as a homeschool parent. And we are really the sort of the resource for them to provide that information.
Senator Mazur.
Regarding homeschools, the Senate passed out a bill last week regarding registration and things of homeschools. In my bill file, I had no negatives and a full stack of positives for the bill, but I've heard since then that there are some problems with the lack of registration and oversight of homeschooling. Do you have any knowledge of that bill, and is it something that needs to be fixed before it is signed by the governor?
Or before Chair Morgan and Senator Messley, I'm aware of the bill. I have Joni Gillis in my office who has followed that bill very closely. I believe that we do have some questions about the current language and what the intent of the policy is in terms of the state's responsibility for children in the state of Oregon. I think I would recommend that Joni and I visit you to answer any questions that you might have at some other time, but we'd be glad to do that.
Madam Chair, just follow up. I would recommend that you go talk to the House. It's out of our hands at this point.
Well, I would assume that Representative Backlund has that on his roster to take up very shortly.
We have been following, Madam Chair and Senator, we've been following this very closely, and Joni Gillis is very aware of the issues and has been providing testimony at the committees as it moves through the system. If you have specific questions, we'd be glad to answer those for you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley,
just to follow up, if the department has a position on the bill and that if that position has been committed to writing, would like to see that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be information that some of us didn't have when the bill came to for debate in the Senate.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, we'd be glad to provide that to you.
Thank you.
And I'll have Joni visit you and bring that information to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please
We're down to the last slide, almost the last slide. We do in our office.
Can you talk to us about GED options?
I'm sorry, I missed that one, didn't I? GED options is a program that we administer through our office that provides GED services to children. That still remain in the public school setting. GED, generally speaking, is for students that exit the public school setting and enter a GED program that provides the GED when they pass the assessments, the national assessments. We did find, however, that in the vein of trying to keep kids in school, GED does provide an option to some students that are qualified so that they can start studying and in fact, pass the GED assessments while they're still under the supervision of the public school system. That provides them an opportunity to stay with their peer group. It provides them an opportunity to continue to participate in some work in the school, academics, activities that students should, in fact, participate in, and we try to keep them linked to the public school system as much as possible. This, for some students in the state, is a very realistic and a very important option so that they maintain that link to the public schools, they maintain some relationship with teachers and administrators in the schools, and still can study towards the GED as they do that. It's actually a very low-cost program. It's maybe a quarter of a time FTE of someone in my office working with both staff in my offices, and actually the whole department, working with community colleges, Office of Community Colleges, and with schools to try to maintain kids in school. I mean, really the issue is try to prevent kids from becoming detached. I remember that Pat Burke said earlier that one of the issues with kids and the loss of kids from the public school system is they become detached, they get alienated from the system. This is one way to prevent that, and it's a way to keep the kids attached and participating in public school systems.
So would we be correct in assuming then that there are not an awful lot of students that are involved in this program?
I believe that we, oh, here it is right here on my notes, 2,432 students this year. So not an awful lot of kids against 500,000 plus. It's a lot of kids when you think about dropouts and children that would leave the system. We've prevented kids from leaving the system through providing this additional option to them.
Thank you.
Last slide that I'll speak to, because really the last slide is sort of a summary statement, and that is our regional services support for all of the counties in the state of Oregon. Although this is not a requirement of statute or rule in the Department of Education, what we found over the years in the curriculum instruction field services is that people need to know. People need to understand what the standards are about, what Title IIA is about, what Title IID is about. They need to know where we're going with things, how the Department of Education is administering things, these different programs and services, and the best way to do that is to go work with them in their counties. So we have a number of staff that are assigned to what we call the regional services teams. These people are really our communications link, both information going out and information coming back to the Department of Education. What do we need to tell them in terms of how we operate and what are we doing with these different federal and state grant programs, federal and state operations, but also what do they need from the Office of Curriculum Instruction Field Services? What services would they like to have? How can we address the needs that they have? This is really a low overhead. It's an important arm of the office, but it's a very low overhead arm. And our staff go out and visit once a month in each county, have a meeting with curriculum directors and others that are involved in the work that Curriculum Instruction Field Services represents, meet with them, interact with them, present information, and then also get feedback, get information from them that helps us determine where is our best, what's our best logistical success in terms of organizing and delivering resources to these schools.
Madam,
it's very effective. It works very well, and schools really appreciate it.
Senator Gorgon.
Thank you. Does this describe a role that is in partnership with the education service districts?
Actually, Chair Morgan and Senator Gordley, we work through the education service districts when we go do these visits because we're only there for, generally speaking, one day. And, oh, by the way, if you go to LeGrand, that one day turns into about 3 hours because you're traveling back and forth or you're doing other activities with schools. So we work very close-handedly with the ESDs. They help us organize the meetings. They bring people together. We usually hold it in the ESD facilities. They kind of facilitate for us so that our staff really can concentrate on the message and the information we're trying to collect and make that most efficient, make it the most efficient meeting possible. ESDs are very willing to do this because it also assists them in knowing how schools are responding, how school districts, what are the needs of the school districts. We can work with ESDs then on the best way to logistically deliver services to schools. And with that,
yeah, I don't want to be cutting anybody off prematurely here, so I'm going to.
I believe I'm finished, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And I'll call back Mr. Koski to finish the presentation on technology and information resources. Mr. Koski, before I have you go ahead on finishing your presentation, first of all, let me apologize for cutting you off. I did that very inadvertently, and I'm very sorry for any inconvenience that I caused you. But if you could possibly give us the 1.5-minute 090 class on what it takes to add the teacher to the student in the database initiative, I would appreciate that.
Madam Chair, for the record, again, my name is Doug Costi, Director of Technology School Finance. I'd be happy to, and you don't need to apologize for cutting me short. It gave me a nice break. the thumbnail overview of the discussion on linking the student to the teacher is, first of all, from a high-level perspective, technology is seldom the barrier that we face in these issues. It really comes down to policy issues. But in the specific area of linking a student to a teacher, you need to consider the types of courses that are being taught and the infrastructure of the classroom. Let's say, for example, in an elementary district or an elementary school, we have block schedules where multiple teachers provide instruction to an individual student. You have what we call in database terms a one-to-many relationship. unlike the classical elementary school where one teacher teaches a group of children for the entire period, the entire day. There it's easy to tie the relationship from a student to a teacher. Once you move into the secondary, so I've given you two scenarios now. One is the classic elementary school relationship, one-to-one, one teacher, one student. The next is the block schedule where you have two teachers potentially teaching two classes to the same student, and then they go to another block and do the same type of thing. That gets into a one-to-many. Then you move into the high school or the secondary level where you have groups of teachers over different semesters or periods of time teaching the students. So you get into this one-to-many relationship, and now you bring coursework into the equation as well. So it becomes a connection of three entities, if you will, teachers, courses, and students. And that's what I tried to explain yesterday in terms of the difficulty in tying it all together. Through technology, nothing's impossible, but you can do that fairly well in a school environment. You move out to the district, it gets a little more challenging, and then from a statewide perspective, even more challenging. Not impossible to overcome. We're more than willing to do that and look at those opportunities. But that's my database version of why it is difficult to tie them all together.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. To kick off, you might want to point out that the school finance presentation begins on page 17 of my previous presentation under the technology tab. And I apologize for combining them. I probably should have had a separate PowerPoint in there or a tab for school finance.
We have it mixed in. Let's see.
Oh, there.
Okay.
Is everybody on page here?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
We are ready.
So the chart on page 17 outlines the budget for the Office of School Finance. And as I mentioned in technology yesterday, what this does not reflect are the FTE that were technical staff that I moved into the technology division. However, there's approximately $2.5 million that stayed in this budget because we didn't reallocate it over to school finance or to the Office of Technology. So in addition to the folks that I have in technologies, there's approximately 10 school finance staff that provide a lower level of analysis, data collection, and state school fund calculation estimates and information processing. This staff also is used for the quality ed modeling, as well as school and state report card information data gathering.
If I might take advantage of this pause, we have, again, in the back, a group of students from Westland Middle School in Corvallis who are here today. And just to give you some information, we're doing a public hearing on the operations budget for the Department of Education. So these are the folks that keep watch over the K-12 school system.
Madam Chair?
Senator.
I need to clarify for the last 2 days I've been introducing the students from Corvallis because they sent the information to the wrong senator, so you will be introduced today on the Senate floor by Senator Morris instead of myself. So.
Thank you. And we're very glad to have you at the Capitol. I think that all of us agree that it's important for students to understand how government works and understand that you can be part of this too.
I'll continue. As you can see by this slide, there are several areas that we focus on in the Office of School Finance. In contrast to the technology division, while these folks are fairly technical, they're more analytical. They provide analysis on the data that we collect, and they know their data extremely well. So we have two basic activities in this office. The first is the state school fund formula activity. this is the process that we go through to get that chunk of money that you tell us we're going to get each year or each biennium, and then put it through the various formulas to support state school fund, facilities grants, ESDs, and those kind of things. So there are formula activities to provide estimates, and there's a lot of communication going out to the field in terms of once we get those estimates, what does that mean to us, and we provide that information out of that formula group. The second piece of it is the state finance policy support. As I stated earlier, we provide staffing to the Quality Ed Commission through economic analysis and administrative support. We also provide the report card staff, so the information that is collected and reported on the school and district report cards is funneled through this group, too. They do the high-level analysis of the data that's being collected. Slide 19 points out how we've been doing. This office does a very good job of providing comparable financial data, collecting it, and putting information out on the web through this database initiative reports. It also provides timely and accurate payments to school districts. We work with them whenever changes to the funding come up. We put them on notice in terms of what that means to them, so we're their first line of communications. Over the past biennium, for example, following the governor's vetoes in August of 2002, we revised the schedules in a matter of 24 hours. Before the kickoff of the 2003 legislative session, we provided a new quality education model and quality education report. And today we are recalculating the estimates that will be posted either later today or first thing in the morning for the 03-04 funding based on the co-chair's budget. The next slide points out some of those areas where we still need to improve. And I think I touched on this a bit yesterday in my presentation on technology. While we're doing a lot of good work with aggregated data collections, there's opportunities to look at consolidating those collections and reducing the burden on school districts. We can provide more analytical support for policymakers. We can do a better job of reporting, more accurate, more timely reports, a better variety of reports. The school fund application is in an old version of a spreadsheet that we're currently updating and moving into a newer version. We're automating the processes to take the information that's collected through the web-based data collections and making it flow smoother into this formula so that there is not it removes some of the opportunities for error and revising numbers.
Can you give me a kind of a working definition of what the school fund application actually is?
Yeah, actually, it's if you think about the state school fund formula, the biggest chunk of it is what we call average daily membership weighted. Those numbers are comprised of the regular attendance of students, the ESL weightings, the special ed weightings, the delinquent and neglected weightings. There's four or five different categories, and they each get different weights. So if you think about that in terms of that piece of it, that piece is like what we call a tab on a spreadsheet. So we put all of that data on a spreadsheet for every single district, and we calculate then what the ADMW is, the weighted value per student. Okay, that's one component. Then we have another tab that calculates information that's pulled from the school audits on local revenues. So we gather that information, put it on the spreadsheet. All of this information is collected in phases. Initially, we don't know what it is, so the school provides an estimate to us. So in the first round, we get some estimates, we post them, we run the calculation. Excuse me.
And what's the time frame that the first round takes place in?
Well, for example, as of today, we're doing the first estimate for the 03-04 biennium based on your budget. Once we get a budget, well, this is actually the second one. I believe the governor's base budget gave us initial one, but no, I take that back. This is our first one for 03-04. Okay, then later on in the year, when we land on a number, for example, when we get the May forecast, and if that number needs to be tweaked, or at the end of the session, we'll provide a revised estimate. Then we get some actual information in the fall, and we update that formula again. So we continue to tweak it as the numbers get tighter and tighter, so that as they progress through the year, they get a better idea of where they're at, based on actuals as opposed to estimates.
I can appreciate the jello-like nature of the problem that you have to grapple with here. If you don't know the funding coming at the front end of the system and you don't know how the student count's going to finally shake out, it must be quite an interesting project at certain points in time.
Chair Morgan, correct, it is. And fortunately, we don't do it in a vacuum. We have many partners at the table that are with us to go through the process. DAS, LFO, our friends at COSA and OSBA, and some very talented staff within the agency get together and make sure that, you know, all of the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and we pass this information around and make sure that we're accurate before we go out. So a lot of communication behind the scenes going on. The other part I'd like to point out is, historically, there hasn't been a lot of backup and cross-training. Everybody knew their little niche, and we had staff in there that had been around for many, many years. So what we're really having to do today going forward is document very well those processes so that anybody can come in that has some financial or analytical background, pick up these tools and put it through the process, and that there are backup and cross-trained staff so that they don't just know their little area of focus, that they can pick up and carry forward on the other side. But a lot of work needs to be done in that area as well. That's why I pointed out here. So looking ahead, what are we going to do going forward? Again, the recent federal mandates to collect this disaggregated data at this lower level has provided us opportunities to identify methods to streamline the process. We're planning to maintain the existing spreadsheet in an updated version. The previous biennium, or the 0103 biennium, we had some funding in that budget for going out to contract and building a database to support the state school fund formula. We're basically on hold with that project and have just put in the sound policies and procedures to accurately do it. But that's something we need to do going forward. We need a better way to house that information historically so that we can report on it in a more web-based dynamic fashion. And going forward, again, our staff is working with other divisions or other offices throughout the agency to coordinate these data collections and looking for opportunities to consolidate so that we ask for the information one time for all purposes. That concludes my presentation on school finance.
Senator Messner.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I might ask Mr. Costa a question related to the response we got this morning for my questions yesterday. Would that be appropriate this time? And I want to learn more about how you track students from school to school and state to state. Question number one is, your answer indicates that there is not district access right now to track students that move from one district within the state to another. When do you expect that will be available?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, we'll have to look at what the budget looks like coming out of this, but there's a couple of factors that are involved in terms of how we would monitor the movement of kids from school to school. One is you could do it from a statewide perspective out of the Student Center database, but as Representative Smith astutely pointed out yesterday, there are some significant issues with confidentiality that we must address prior to making that information available. And those are policy decisions and policy considerations that need to be dealt with before we can do it. Technology, again, is there aren't that many barriers to doing this from a technological perspective. The barriers are more policy related. And if we don't point out the issues with data confidentiality and the little traps that lay along the way, we would be remiss as technology folks.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. And I strongly support Representative Smith's concern, but it also seems to me that there's a tremendous gap with the number of students that do move, not only within the state but outside of state. If I could make a second question. Actually, I have three, Madam Chair.
Just let it roll, Senator.
Oh, good. Here we go. Hang on. I'm concerned about not being able to track those that are coming in or leaving the state. Is the secure student ID not nationwide? It is only a number that's allocated for the state of Oregon?
Representative Morgan, Senator Messerly, that is correct. Each state, it's not a requirement that each state has a secure ID or a process similar to what Oregon has, but without it, addressing the requirements of No Child Left Behind become very difficult. The federal government has not mandated, that is not a federal ID that is tacked on a child that would allow us to follow their progress throughout the system in any state. That is an Oregon ID.
One more follow-up, Madam Chair. But the school districts themselves that are receiving the student can contact the previous district or the previous state and request that information, or at least a lot of the information. Is that true?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions or comments for Mr. Costi? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I will call back Mr. Seward wearing his other hat in the Office of Special Education.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I am the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Special Education. I forgot my baseball caps today. I usually have them that I can switch back and forth.
Well, that is a political statement around here, so we'll yeah. just...
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, don't know the inside, sorry.
It might be behooving to have a batter's helmet.
So my catcher's outfit I forgot, and so my shin guards, I guess. I would like to provide you some information about the operation of the Office of Special Education, the programs and services that we provide. And as you see with the first slide, again, this is one that you are familiar with. It gives a brief overview of the funding for the Office of Special Education. Look at the total of about $514+ million on a biennial basis. The vast majority of those funds being dispersed directly to school districts, to state-operated programs, state-supported programs for direct services for their children. We operate with 31.5 FTE, and as you'll see as I go through the presentation, that these people's time is well used. in fact, probably overused. We have very committed, very dedicated staff in the Office of Special Education who work many, many hours beyond what their duties would predict, ensuring that students are receiving services that they need and are required under federal and state law. The first slide really talks briefly about what is the purpose of the Office of Special Education. Our purpose in the office is to implement and manage programs and services for children with disabilities that meet both state and federal law for services for children with disabilities. As you are well aware, the children with disabilities are protected under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, but is also protected under civil rights law, Section 504 of the Civil Rights Act of 1973, and other civil rights requirements, and also through a voluminous, I think would be a good word, case history, legal actions, court cases, complaint resolutions, due process hearings resolutions that provide us with the guidance and the parameters for how those programs and services are provided to children. But at the end of all of that, what we're really talking about are children who are vulnerable. They are children who have disabilities that need assistance, that need compensatory services in order to be members of our society in the full terms of being a member of our society. And that really is, regardless of the law, the purpose of the Office of Special Education is to help ensure that those children have the full ability to live as an American in our society. The next slide I'm going to go through a series of about six different functions or areas in our office where we organize and deliver our resources. The first of those is in a set of programs that I refer to as state-operated programs. These are programs where the state really, on a day-to-day basis, has responsibility for the education of the children that are placed in those programs. I'm going to talk about one specifically, the Early Intervention and Early Childhood Special Education Program, that is directly operated out of the Office of Special Education, but I just want to let you know that in the next few days, we'll also be talking about additional programs that are state-operated programs. We'll talk about the Youth Corrections Education Program and the Juvenile Detention Programs. I think that presentation will be early next week. We also operate the State School for the Deaf and the State School for the Blind. Jane Mulholland will be here to make that presentation to you when that occurs on the agenda. So I want to return back to the program that we operate directly out of the department, out of the Office of Special Education, under program managers in that office, the Early Childhood, Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program. It's a state-operated program for children who are birthed to school age, birth to five, given their birthday on September 1st. We provide all of the direct services for these children through a set of contractors that we employ to provide the organization and the service base regionally across the state. We're providing services on a census count taken on December 1, about 7,154 children birth through five this year at an average cost of $7,390 per child. Now, you have to remember that this is an average cost, that we have children that, in fact, have very severe needs that require services that use a great deal more money than the $7,100, $7,300, $7,400. But it is an averaging out, so we have some children that would require services that cost a little bit less. But we have the full range of disabilities in this program to the very severe and multiply disabled children. They require exceptional levels of services in order to ensure their education, ensure their development so that they can participate in school as they enter the public school system. One of the primary purposes of this program, by the way, is that children, as we catch them as early as possible in life, and catch them at their very earliest developmental point in life, that we can, in fact, make gains that if they didn't have that service, would never make those gains the rest of their lives. So it really is important that we catch these children as early as possible, identify their needs, and provide those services. What the projection is and what we have some research that supports is that if you do that, then, in fact, you spend less dollars as they enter the public school system and are provided special education services through the public school system and later in adult life, that it requires less resources to do that. That's sort of the dollar and cents side. The human side is that we have more functionally capable individuals as adults in our society that are more independent, can make more decisions for themselves, can help themselves more, the earlier that we catch them in their developmental career. And birth 3 and 3 to 5-year-olds are the times when we need to get to those children, provide those services, assist those parents, and so those children can develop appropriately, as appropriately as they can.
Mr. Siebert, how do you track these students through their involvement in the early intervention, early childhood program into the K-12 system?
How do we now, and how can we in the future? We currently track these children, generally speaking, because the program people in the early intervention early childhood special education program knows these kids intimately. They work with the school districts, so these children's movement from the preschool programs into the kindergartens, school-age programs, follow them directly and can report on those kids as they make that transition. We're also working right now with the technology, with Doug Costi and others, so that we can start using the SSID system so that we can identify those children and make them integrate them into our data system as soon as possible so that we can actually track through our data management process and follow those children over time. We have some capability right now. We don't have the full capability we'd like to have.
So currently, they're tracked when they come into the K-12 system like every other student is tracked?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. They do receive the SSID system numbers. They are integrated in the school system as regular students and are tracked as regular students.
Then through the early intervention, early childhood piece, how are they tracked right now?
Madam Chair, as I said before, we currently depend on the excellent program managers and teachers that we have in those programs to keep track of those students. We keep a record of those students through the student census system in special education so that we have a record of those individual students as they make progress through the intervention early childhood special education program. We're waiting for the link with the SSID so that we can track those kids in other ways around assessment results and around movement across the state, et cetera. But we have a fairly sophisticated special education tracking system. We want to get that integrated with the overall state system.
And is the data housed in the Department of Ed or in DHS?
All that data is housed in the Department of Education.
Okay.
We have a rather massive data system. I remember somebody asked this question of Doug Costi earlier about the special education data. We've been required under federal law since 1977 to keep individual student data at the Department of Education and report that to the federal government. So we've had that. And we did, in fact, I think you asked the question, do we do this on paper? I managed that system from about 1983 to 88, and it was a paper system. We had teachers filling out pieces of paper that turned it in. We had to log it into the computers. We've made tremendous progress since that time in making this an integrated database system, and we're making very strong headway into integrating that then with the other data systems we have on children in the department.
Representative Smith, did you have a question?
I do. Through the Department of Human Services and some of their early childhood programs, they have identified children who need help,
mm-hmm.
usually medical help and the most basic need help. Do you coordinate any of your education efforts with DHS, for instance, on Babies First? And there's a couple of different programs now. So is that how they're initially identified and information is sent to you?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the answer is absolutely. Coordinate with the Department of Human Services. The staff in the office meet with them on a regular basis to ensure that there's continuity amongst the services we're trying and reduce any possible overlap so we make the most efficient use of the state dollars possible. One of the ways that we do pick up children for referral into early childhood special education and early intervention is through DHS agencies in the communities, but we also become aware of these children through doctors. We provide the doctors with a great deal of information about the programs and services that we provide so that as they come in contact with the children, they can give parents information about a referral to our programs. We pick up a number of children that way. Parents bring their children in and say, I think my child may have a problem, may have a disability, and we ensure that those children are evaluated, and if they're eligible, they're served.
Very good. That's probably government working at its most efficient level. I'm glad to hear that, since DHS, I think, does a good job of identifying these at-need, at-risk children, and then to coordinate with the Department of Education and getting them in the early intervention. I think that's probably a good use of time and money.
Representative Mark.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, this is an area I'm very concerned about. I think these kinds of programs, early intervention, is absolutely critical in making sure that these young people can become productive students later and productive adults. And I'm a little concerned that you are here wearing two hats. What is the department's commitment to this? I was looking at the org chart. And, of course, you've got SIFs over on one side, but special ed also has youth corrections and special schools under it. So how long do you intend to wear these two hats, and is one of them hard?
Well, I have thought seriously about having to grow another head pretty soon. The Department of Education did need assistance with the Office of Special Education. Actually, I moved into the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services because of the need for someone with some experience and knowledge of the operations and how things go to move into the position as those associates left the Department of Education. I went into the Office of Curriculum Instruction October 4th of last year. I've had a very good experience. They're absolutely best staff, I think, that I don't want to hurt the Office of Special Education staff's feelings, but I've really had a very good experience in curriculum instruction and field services. They're highly competent, highly dedicated group of people. We've recently had a second associate superintendent leave from the Office of Special Education, and the leadership in the department, knowing that I came from that office originally, I spent 24 and a half years in the Office of Special Education. I have a considerable experience with special education students and as a teacher and then as administrator of the Department of Ed. If I could, for a period of time, manage both offices, and I guess I wasn't thinking very carefully at the time, but I said, sure, I could do that. And had, I think, have been fairly successful, given that I still have a workload that's fairly large. We have plans and are moving towards a June 1 transition from my working in the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. Another associate superintendent will be taking over those responsibilities, and we'll be merging two offices to in our organizational restructuring process. So at that time, I'll move into a full-time job at the Office of Special Education.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Mesrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get back to the slide that's before us. I see you've got contractors that you work with, but they obviously don't cover the whole state. Can I assume that the rest of the students are being serviced by their local school districts then, or how are they covered?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, actually we have eight contractors, I believe, and they do in fact have territories that are larger than ESDN school boundaries. So we may have a contractor, for instance, Crook Deschutes ESD, actually serves across four counties. So our county boundaries we've established very carefully. They were originally established, by the way, in 1983, for the EIECSE program in 1991. We ensured that every child that needed the services was within a region that we had for which we had a contractor. So we are very careful to make sure that there's no children that somehow fall in the cracks of our map, basically.
Okay, just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
So these contractors do cover the entire state?
Madam Chair, Senator Messley, absolutely. Yeah, we're very careful about that.
If I might just roll backwards here a little bit, and I think you probably covered this and I wasn't tracking. But going back to the pie charts on the funding at the first slide that we looked at, can you talk to us about what the other fund components of this, where that money comes from?
Madam Chair, the other funds components of the overall budget really come from exclusively from one source. As you're probably aware, in the budgeting practices of state agencies, that funds that are passed from one agency to another in a budgetary way become general funds. No matter if they started out as federal funds or some other resource, they become other funds in our agency. In this particular case, we have the Youth Corrections Education Program and the Juvenile Detention Program that start out as state school funds that are passed to us through the state school fund distribution process, and they become other funds in our budget.
Okay, so it's a state to cover those two programs.
Yes, by and large, yeah.
And while we have this break, I think we have another group of students in the back from Westland Middle School in Corvallis. Welcome, and a little bit of information. We're doing the Department of Education budget right now, and the Department of Education interfaces into your lives because it oversees the functioning of the K-12 school system. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. I want to self-correct here. I actually said 8 contractors earlier about the Early Intervention Early Childhood Special Education Program. Actually, we have 9 contractors at the time. This comes from being around a long time and not remember which number applies at what particular point in time. We have, at this point, starting with item number 4 on that same slide, about 1,933 children that are early intervention children. That's birth through 2 years old. And we have 5,221 children that are the 3 to 5 or 3 to school age, 3 to pre-K in our program. Now, what you need to remember is that these are fixed point in time numbers, that these numbers change over time. They become significantly higher in March, and they become significantly lower. And this is really a December 1 child count out of our state data system for children with disabilities. But this is a very as mobile a population as unchangeable a population as you'll find in any school district in the state. After all, you remember that they do represent children from all over the state. They also represent all the ethnicity groups. They represent all the disability groups. They represent they are a mirror image of our society, and except that they do need to have services as children with disabilities. I think we'll skip the next slide. I made the point earlier about youth corrections and juvenile detention in the two state schools coming in to make reports later in on your agenda. I want to move briefly through slide 6, which is really a representation of the governor's balanced budget for early intervention, early childhood special education. I want to make just 2 comments about this. One is that you'll see in the operations column what looks like a fairly large number, $3.8 million. The Department of Education, and this represents, by the way, the way that the federal government allocates dollars to the state of Oregon and to the Department of Education. We're allowed to keep out of our Part C grant, the Birth 3 grant, about 5% of the allocation. The rest must go through and provide services directly to children. We do that pass-through exactly as we're required by law. The 619, Part B 619, I know these are just jargon words to you, but this is the program that covers the 3 to 5 year old population. Allows the state to retain 5% for administration and 20% for statewide activities. Several biennia ago, as caseloads grew and there were programs that were increasing their needs for services to kids that had significant disabilities that required high-cost services, and we were being pinched a little bit in the budget, the Department of Education made the choice that we would not continue to take that 25%. That would retain 10%, and we passed the additional 15% that the state had as a possible use for statewide work through to our contractors so that we can continue to resource those programs according to the needs of the children and their IFSPs that had been worked out by those programs. So the $3.8 million contains money that's allocated to us that we turn into grant aid and pass back out to our contractors for direct services to kids. That leaves us, by the way, with a fairly thin administrative budget. For a very significant obligation to make sure that we have good coordination across 9 contractors, that they're receiving training so that their teachers are as highly qualified as the federal law requires for all teachers in the state of Oregon, that they have the resources from the Department of Education that they need in order to be able to communicate with us and give us information and continue on their work. But it's, I think, a very important point that the state did make that choice, and we're living with that choice and we'll continue to live with that choice.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Could you say again the 25% that we chose not to take had the result of what? What did we lose in making that choice?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, the funds that are allocated to the state, the 25% of the funds that is in the 3-5 grant program that we have allowed us to keep 25% of the funds for state administration and statewide activities. The rest of the funds, 75%, that we're obligated to pass through to, it'd be like passing it through to the school districts, except it's through to our contractors that provide services to that age group. The department made the choice that those funds are better used and have more value passed through to our contractors for direct services. And it was based on a lot of things that were coming together at that time, increased costs of some students. The services that are needed are very expensive, and we needed to provide resource and support to those contractors. We believe, I think, inherently in the Department of Education that our primary job is to provide services to students. We're going to keep absolutely the least amount of money that we can get by on to do that. If you do the calculations, you'll see that we have that leaves us over a biennium with about $1.2 million in state resources. Now, with those funds, we have been developing and testing and implementing an assessment system for the EI ECSC programs, early intervention, early childhood special education, so we can, on a statewide basis, document student growth. This is in along the same vein that we have student assessments for children who are in schools. We should be able to track those students through our programs into the public school system in terms of student growth and achievement. We also operate a licensure system for early intervention teachers. We pay for and operate that licensure system. That's a significant amount of money on an annual basis to ensure that our teachers are highly qualified and that we have standards for those teachers and administrators and instructional support services. So the $1.3 million over 2 years really takes us to the bone, to be honest with you, in being able to do what we need to do with kids by passing through those additional dollars and still maintain the level of support that our contractors need from our office.
I need some additional clarification, too, and this may be something that you want to go back and research, but I'm looking at the under the tab, and this relates again to the question on the other funds on the pie graph in the front of this section. I'm looking at the youth corrections part of the presentation in the binder, and I'm seeing that the other funds component there is about $23 million, and I'm wondering how that interfaces with the other funds component of your special education budget, which appears to be somewhere around $13 million. And so I'm wondering if you could just get me some clarification on that.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to do that. My guess is when we did the change on the charts that showed the $23 million inside of the slides, that we probably didn't get to the first slide to make the change. We made that change after we'd actually given you the slides. I'll be glad to do the research and bring you those exact numbers.
Thank you very much. And please proceed.
Okay. There's a series of programs also, after we're leaving the topic of state operated programs, early intervention, early childhood special ed, junior, JDEP and YSEP, you know, the trade names for youth corrections programs and the state schools, and to a set of programs that I refer to as state supported programs. And there are several of these, and what I want to do is walk you through what these programs are, what the legislature's policy has been in establishing these programs. But these programs basically are for students who have, who are the responsibility of the local school district. But the state has, through its policy, established additional support through grant and aid to provide services to those kids as they're being served on a day-to-day basis by the local schools. The first of these are the regional programs. One of the advantages of being around forever is that I was actually running a regional program from 1981 to 83 when the state was considering and adopting the regional program model that was put into statute in 1983. The original purpose of this program was twofold. One is to provide absolutely the best quality of services to a set of students we refer to as sensory impaired students, students who are deaf or hearing impaired, blind or vision impaired, children who have orthopedic impairments, and children who have autism. These children, by and large, require a level of service that, generally speaking, exceeds what would be an average cost of a child with disabilities in the public school system. So the cost is one of the issues. The other issue is that these children, because of the sensory impairments, require a very high level of skill in the teachers that provide the services. So these are teachers that are trained to be teachers of children with vision impairments and who are blind, teachers who are trained specifically to work with kids who are deaf and hard of hearing. These kids are dispersed all over the state, in every school district, every region of the state, every geographic location, and we had a problem at that time in 83 to determine how best to organize services so we get the best trained people to those children. And we determined that you couldn't do it as a school district. School districts just don't have the wherewithal, the critical mass to do that. And so we established a structure called the regional programs. Two benefits. One is there's some cost efficiency in providing teachers across multiple districts, across geographic areas, that any individual district may not be able to afford or would come at a very high price. And secondly, you provide highly qualified people. You can hire better teachers. You can hire more qualified teachers to do that job on a regional basis by building a critical mass of children across the geographic areas.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Are the contractors under the second bullet then related to the regional programs that you're describing in the first bullet?
Yes, I'm sorry. That should probably have been a number and then a bullet, or a bullet and then numbers. But you'll see in the slide it says regional programs, and it talks about the disabilities that are served. The subsequent bullets talk about those regional programs.
Then I thought I heard you say, the follow-up, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. that school districts are not included as contractors, but I do see that Portland Public Schools is listed as a contractor, which then leads me to the question, why not Multnomah ESD as the contractor as opposed to Portland Public Schools? What's the situation there?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, the regional program set up in 1983 by our then superintendent. Basically was established through a set of basically through ESDs, except for one case, and that was Portland Public Schools. Actually, there's another case that went by the wayside a while back. Portland Public Schools at that time was running a regional program service. And what Vern Duncan did at that time is to use agencies that had an established resource base and an established capacity to do that. Portland Public Schools at that point had a program. And so he utilized that resource to establish that regional program in the northern central part of the state or valley part of the state. We have been notified by Portland Public Schools, by the way, that they intend not to contract with us for a couple of our regional EICSC and regional programs in the future. We're now working with Multnomah County ESD specifically to become a contractor for the department. We've also worked with Clackamas ESD and Northwest Region ESD to do the same thing. So the structure is transitioning. We're making sure that we have good capacity in the contractors we select.
Thank you.
Can you read that one?
I hear footprints coming up behind me. regional programs serve 6,100 approximately children across the state, birth through 21, and at an average cost of about $4,100. Here again, you need to realize that some of those children exceed that amount and some are a little bit less expensive. So this is really an average cost. The count's based on our December 1 count, the regular child census that we do for special education. This is a significant program. This is a very important program. And let me kind of just give you my impression, having been with it for these many years, that school districts, particularly medium and small-sized school districts that may have one deaf child, cannot pay for the quality of the teacher and the level of services that we provide them through a regional structure. We could deliver the money back to them, break up the money, take the $30 million, chunk it out, and give each district their proportional amount. They couldn't purchase the level of services that we provide through the regional program. This truly is a cost-efficient program that provides a very highly qualified level of service for very needy kids. And that was the reason the 1983 legislature set it up that way, and I believe that that those same arguments, though debatable, can be made today.
Representative Smith.
I don't doubt the importance of this program. I'm concerned about the funding, especially with some of our small schools. I've got, every legislator probably has an example of this. I've got a small school in my district who had to transport a special education student from South Clackamas County to, I think, Multnomah ESD because of the need. And they had, the cost was $50,000 a year for this one student by the time he added all that up. Now, I was led to believe a lot of that cost was borne by the school district. Is that true in a situation like that? Because we look at your average cost for students, and you said they are higher and lower. But I think there's several, many examples of the cost to educate these students is far outreaching the funding level. Can you address that?
I can. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the fit, really have to think about the fit in the overall policy that the legislature has established over many years about how we address certain children with certain types of disabilities and certain children because of the cost that those children incur at, for transportation costs or a whole variety of costs that those children incur for a school district. One of the ways that we've offset that cost for school districts is through the regional programs. We provide some additional dollars through the regional structure to offset those same costs that districts would have to spend if the regional programs didn't exist. This is a way that the state has established in policy to assist school districts for certain costs of kids with that have very high level of needs. We also have programs that I'll talk about in a few minutes, other kinds of programs that do the same thing. The basic policy is to offset, for some reason in policy, costs that school districts would otherwise incur themselves. Regional programs, because we believe that the critical mass that regional programs develop will provide cost efficiencies as well as an increased quality of the services they provide. Now, we have numbers of disabilities out there that, in fact, will require levels of services that will incur significant costs that are not provided through the regional programs, not provided through the state schools, not provided through the other programs that we operate, the state-supported programs. Senate Bill 550 is one attempt by the legislature to take a look at those children and figure out some way to help school districts that are having this high-level expense caused by one child in the school district or two children in the school district. And I've been working with both House and Senate Revenue in developing the Senate Bill 550 concept. I believe it's the right concept. It wouldn't be monies that would go to these children that are we currently have mechanisms for. It would try to address the needs of children in school and school districts are incurring costs for, where they have no place else to go. We've all heard the horror stories of particularly small districts that have a huge financial hit on their budgets because a family moves into town. That's unfair to the school district, and I think the legislature's attempt to work with policy that would help offset that, alleviate that district, is very appropriate.
I'm not familiar with Senate Bill 550, but in your attempt to solve this problem, are you taking money out of the basic school fund to offset that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, correct. I think I'd be glad to come and talk to you a little bit about Senate Bill 550, but basically the idea is that you set aside a certain amount of money for children who require services that are very expensive services that no longer fit it within the averaging. I think the idea in 1991 about the second weight formula for special education was an idea that somehow these would all average out, that students that don't require quite that amount of money would average out with kids that require more. What we've learned from school districts over the last 4, 5, 6 years is that we have significant changes in our population. We have children with very significant needs that the averaging doesn't work for anymore, and we need to address that.
And you're right, and these problems seem to be just, for the parents, insurmountable. The cost is outrageous when you look at it, and it's a huge hit on our local budgets. Of course, we know part of the problem is the federal mandate, and it's our federal funding on that is so low. If they would even meet the 40%, I think we would think that was a huge windfall to the state. What is George Bush and No Child Left Behind trying to do to address that problem? Because since that program has said all children will be able to read at grade level, and I think, of course, that's impossible looking at the basic needs of some of these kids.
Chair Morgan and Representative Smith, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act is being reauthorized. The discussion is going on as we speak in Congress about the components of the change in that law. there's certainly a very strong lobby, both from the education side as well as from the parent side and other interested parties, that the government step up to the plate and answer the 40% promise it made in 1975. I happen to believe that the problem isn't that we have an Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. I believe these children do and need to have the services that are required under the law. The problem is that the federal government has never stepped up to the plate.
Right.
And I think all of us have a reason to be disconcerted by that, that we're providing a level of services that are right for kids, and the federal government has not responded to their obligation that they set for themselves.
Well, I don't know what we can do to get the federal government to do this, but maybe we can ship all of our lobbyists who are currently in the hallways, send them to Congress, get them out of our hair, and they can bring home some money.
That's one answer. Yeah.
I think you have to find a policy committee to take that one. Darn it. Representative March, did you have a question?
No, I was just going to comment. I wrote to both my senators and met with my congressman on this very issue and asked them to fund it, and I'd urge everybody else to do the same.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Corbin.
Where is Senate Bill 550? In the process?
It was passed out of Senate Revenue, was passed on the floor and approved, and it is now on the House side. I don't believe it's been heard yet in the Senate Revenue, but it's scheduled there. We had there were some questions about the mechanisms inside of that in terms of how you generate and distribute the dollars. Several school districts asked those questions. We've been working on that for the last week and a half. We've met with those school districts and answered their questions. I believe that that's put it back on track on the House Revenue side.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The next state supported program I want to talk about briefly is the long-term treatment and care programs. These are programs for children with significant mental health needs to the point that Department of Human Services, through its agencies in the counties, make placements of these children in either day treatment programs or in residential treatment programs, and there's 53 of these programs around the state. These children are there to receive mental health services, and the contract that these programs have with the contractors, the 53 contractors, is to provide the mental health services they pay for and provide the mental health services they pay for and provide where it's a residential program for the cost of that child being in residence during that time. The Department of Education, under state law and under the policy that the legislature established again many years ago, this was very soon followed on the passage of the 94-142 at that time, the Children with Disabilities Act, is that these children, when placed by the Department of Human Services in these locales, in this day treatment program or in this long-term treatment care program, made a significant impact on the education services provided by that local school district. And in fact, it was the state's responsibility to place the children there. It probably should be the state's responsibility to provide the education, offset that cost to the local district while the children are there. The legislature adopted a statute that required that the local district where those programs were located pick up the responsibility for providing the education, but that the state needed to provide the dollars for the educational services while those children in that school district. The school district, based at that time, because there's significant local property tax investment in that school district, that it really shouldn't be the local property tax dollar that supported that educational program. We stepped in, the legislature stepped in, and adopted the policy that the state provide the costs of the education through the Department of Education while the children are in treatment paid by Department of Human Services. We have 1,188 beds. We call them beds because children turn over on a fairly regular basis in these programs. So 1,188 beds or slots. We provide the education to those children as they arrive in those slots at an average cost of $13,092 a year. Now, that seems like a lot of money. But let me just give you a couple of examples. We have children in those programs that have severe mental health needs, many of them having severe behavior problems that require a more intensive teacher-to-student ratio than what we'd normally experience in a public school system and even in many special education programs. These are kids that are very, very needy require a lot of service both from the Department of Human Services and from the Department of Education or the local school district to provide to those kids, and we pay for those costs.
Representative Smith.
Your cost per student of $13,692, is that the cost of education?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, it is. We do not pay for any of the treatment costs in these programs.
And DHS does that.
DHS pays for all those treatment costs. There are points at the interface, you know, what becomes an education versus a treatment cost, and sometimes we split staff up because they provide treatment on one side and they provide education on the other. Mm-hmm. We work very carefully with the Department of Human Services through their local county facilities so that we ensure that we're not paying for the treatment, because clearly the legislative policy is we don't do that.
Yeah, so you're saying this $13,000 is purely the cost of education.
Purely the cost
not
of
any flow-through dollars to DHS for treatment.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, to my best knowledge, this is all education costs, and I have worked with these programs in the past, and I feel pretty comfortable with that. To the extent that it might happen here or there by mistake or oversight, it may.
Right.
But
right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another state-supported program that our office operates is called the Hospital Education Programs. We have several state and private hospitals that are long-term placements for children with critical health needs. They are placed in the hospital through a variety of avenues. They continue to need to have educational services because most of these children are on IEPs when they arrive in the hospital program or soon have them. And so the state's policy has been here. This is a very similar situation to the long-term treatment care programs. These kids arrive at a hospital in Portland Public Schools, for example, and that's where several of these hospitals are located, not at Portland Public Schools' behest or not at their placement of these children. They're not Portland Public School resident students, but they arrive there and they stay from very short periods of time, 3 to 5 days, to many months, because we are talking about critical care kids. We're talking about oncology. We're talking about very severe medical needs. The legislature's policy, again, about the same time that you established the policy for the long-term treatment care program, you believed in that, and we have a statute, that the local district is responsible for the education. They're the best agency around to deliver the services. However, that impact on that school district, the cost of the education, shouldn't be absorbed at that time by local taxpayer dollars at this point by revenue that only the district gets. And so the state stepped in and said, through the Department of Education, we'll pay for the education of these children while they're in those hospital programs. It's a way to offset and alleviate a local school district from uncontrollable costs that come from outside of the school district. If you ever want to visit one of the special education programs and see the true benefit that children receive, one of the hospital programs would be one that I would suggest you visit. You see children who have severe health needs, severe medical needs, that are getting education, that are in the most able way possible, receiving a normalized education program while they're undergoing some very, very serious problems with their health. I worked one of these programs for about 6 months, and it was very hard for me, and so I stopped working mm-hmm. on a hospital program, but it really it taught me what the true meaning of education for children with health needs is.
Madam Chair?
Senator Massaway.
I don't mean to jump away from this subject, but we did skip over talented and gifted, and I don't know if that's going to be picked up.
I apologize for missing that one. Where did I go? Services for talented and gifted.
We have about 5 minutes left in the time that we have today, so maybe covering the talented and gifted program would take up that time, and we could...
I could do this tune in 5 minutes, yeah.
I don't know if we...
Yeah. I'm not sure that I'll answer all the questions, but I can at least talk about the program. Now, this is you bring up a subject that's very near and dear to my heart. The first 14 years I was at the Department of Education, I was the talented and gifted specialist for the department. Worked through the ups and down years, both in funding available and through program implementation and the ebb and flow of how this program has gone over the years. Talented and gifted education is not part of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. However, it is comprised of a group of students that have very unique and individual needs. And one of the reasons it wound up in special education many years ago, actually before my arrival at the Department of Education, in special ed, because of the unique sort of individualized focus that special education brought to addressing the needs of these other children, of talented and gifted children. Also, I must say that in 1975, when the original IDEA, 94-142, was being passed, talented and gifted children was one of the original populations that was proposed by Congress to be included under the service requirements for special education. It dropped off in the discussion somewhere along the line in Congress and didn't become one of the categories addressed, but still that idea that we really are addressing individual needs of very unique kids stuck, and that's why it is in special education today. This has been an ebb and flow program. It's clearly over the course of since 1977 when I came to the Department of Education, with a $1 million second year in the biennium budget for providing resources to school districts to develop programs for special education, through the ensuing years where we in fact have come now in 2003 to no dollars in the budget for talented gifted, we've gone up and down with this program. Some people refer to it as the worst of the unfunded mandates. Other people have referred to this as truly an ability to hang on to an important concept for serving children that have very unique and very special needs. And at least we have a few dollars in the program that will keep school districts focusing attention on these services. As you know, however, in the governor's balanced budget, that the $200,000 of biennium that we had been working with for the last 10 years approximately has been completely reduced.
Question. Oh, go ahead. Briefly,
and I would be very willing also to carry this subject over to when we meet next.
I'll ask my question, and you can prepare for it tomorrow.
Tomorrow we have public testimony, so the discussion will need to be continued on Monday.
Okay. Just my quick question is, it's not well-funded at all. However, in our schools, we're still identifying TNG students, and I'm wondering what benefit that serves.
Be glad to answer that question.
Talk about that.
Sure will.
Senator Mesley?
I'll wait till tomorrow.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon?
Along with another question, which is, why do we continue to segregate students in this manner, talented and gifted? Mm-hmm. Are not all children uniquely gifted?
Why?
So why are we doing this, continuing to do this?
And how?
Why and how? You're making it more difficult now.
I know.
And having talked ourselves to the end of our time, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 5014 and 5015. Do we have any announcements that we need for the rest of the week?
No, Madam Chair.
Just to make sure everybody realizes that tomorrow we have public testimony, so we have a full schedule of folks that are coming in here to talk to us about the Department of Ed budgets, and we'll be
meeting
at 8:30 a.m. for those purposes. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting.
It may be that it should.